friends, good morning. I want to thank Deborah and Beacon Unitarian Church for the privilege of speaking to you this morning. This is now the fourth Unitarian congregation which I have addressed, and I have just had a nibble from a fifth in Victoria. I'm making a collection. I salute the Unitarian Church, especially for its commitment to social justice. When I speak at a Unitarian church, I know that I don't have to make a case for social and political action being part of a religious commitment. Whereas in Anglican churches, I often get the tired old "don't mix religion and politics" response. I once spoke at an Anglican church, which shall be nameless, about the same subject I'm speaking to you this morning, and 2 minutes into my sermon, a man stood up and said, "This isn't a sermon, it's a political lecture, and I'm out of here." And off he went. Fortunately, I knew his name, so I was able to say, "Peace be with you, Dave." And yes, I am still an Anglican after all these years, and many temptations to jump ship. Indeed, I have been accused, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, on occasion of being a Unitarian. When Gandhi was asked what his religion was, he would sometimes say, "I'm a Hindu and a Muslim and a Christian and a Jew." And so sometimes following his example, I'll say, "I'm a Christian, Jewish, Unitarian, pagan." And that usually, you know, raises a few eyebrows, and the discussion gets interesting after that. So I'll be staying for coffee hour, and I'll be happy to sit down with you and discuss what I'm saying about Palestine and Israel with anybody who so desires, in relation, as has already been said, to your national study program leading up to the possibility of a national resolution. I'm going to start with a story, and a very, very sad story. Fadi Al-Kachan, a 26-year-old university graduate in Gaza, died last November. He wasn't killed by a bullet or in a missile strike, but when a simple piece of medical hardware, an implant in his heart, failed. His repeated requests to the Israeli authorities over more than a year to be allowed out of Gaza, which is really under siege. People are in there, they can't get out except with permission of the Israeli Defense Forces. To be allowed out of Gaza for medical treatment, these requests had gone unheeded. According to his family, Israeli security services knew that his life was in danger, but they denied him a permit to attend a medical appointment at a hospital in East Jerusalem. Gaza's own hospitals were in crisis after years of the blockade, and they had warned him they could no longer help him. His family says that following a request for a travel permit, Fadi received a call from somebody identifying himself as from the Shin Bet, which is Israel's intelligence service. Speaking in Arabic, the man said he knew the device in Fadi's heart might explode any minute, and he was urged, and this is a very freighted term, he was urged to cooperate in return for a permit to go to the hospital. He was told he could call the phone number that he could see on his cell phone's display screen and arrange an appointment at Erez, which is the Israeli-controlled crossing, which is the only regular way for Palestinians to exit from Gaza. The agent reportedly rang off with the words, "See you in Tel Aviv," Israel's large coastal city. Fadi sealed his fate by deleting the number on his cell phone. This is only one of thousands of such stories. Stories of children, women, and men in occupied Palestine. Beginning in the fall of 1947, some 750,000 Palestinians were expelled, ethnically cleansed, from the lands in which their ancestors had lived for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. This is the beginning of what Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe in Arabic. It holds the same place in Palestinian consciousness that the word Shoah, which is what Jews call the Holocaust, holds in Jewish and Israeli consciousness, and it carries the same meaning. Now, I have just used the word Jews, which for some people is a word freighted with awkwardness and confusion. I've noticed that some people just can't bring themselves to say Jews. They say Jewish people. The word Jews is too strong for them. And that includes Jews. I've heard Jews talk about Jewish people instead of Jews. So let me clear the decks so far as I can. Is what I am saying this morning anti-Semitic? No. Anti-Semitism is the irrational hatred of Jews just for being Jews. There's that old Irish song, "They scorned us just for being what we are." Anybody remember that line? That's anti-Semitism. Well then, is it anti-Israeli? No. It's no more rational to hate Israelis than it is to hate Canadians or Norwegians. There's such a thing as anti-Semitism. It's a real thing. And it is a particularly vile form of racism. But anti-Israelism, if there is such a word, is just as irrational as anti-Francism, anti-Russiaism, anti-Chinaism, ugly words all. What those of us in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement are against are not the Israelis, but the discriminatory policies of the government of Israel in regard to the Palestinian people. The analogy here is the fact that many of us, I might have picked that up from a comment that was made earlier, are opposed to what we see as mistaken policies of the government of Canada. Right, I'm not always proud of being a Canadian. I'd prefer to be proud of being a Canadian, but sometimes I just can't be. So does that make us anti-Canadian? Self-hating Canadians? Of course not. In being critical of the policies of the government of Canada, we are in fact expressing our concern for the well-being of Canada. And you know what the word well-being in Hebrew is shalom. We think it's peace, and it is peace, but it has a deeper meaning, which is well-being on every level. And in being critical of the policies of the government of Israel, we are expressing our concern for the well-being of Israel as a nation. I have no intention of demonizing Israel or romanticizing the Palestinians. What I'm asking is that we treat both communities and our own Canadian society on the basis of the same standards of justice. No double standards. No exceptionalism. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Hebrew Bible will know that there's nothing new about criticizing Israel. Here's what the prophet Amos, who lived in the 8th century before the Common Era, we're talking 2,800 years ago, says about his own people, putting the words in God's mouth. I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But, let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. There's so much irony here. Our Western sense of social justice originates in the writings of the Hebrew prophets. Interestingly, not the philosophers of Greece, but the prophets of Israel. Yet, the government of Israel, which often presents itself as representing Jews worldwide as well as its own citizens, in ignoring the words of the prophets, the line just came into my head, the words of the prophets are written on the tenement halls. Who said that? Paul Simon? Is it? Yeah, okay. Yes, we'll read them there, because the government is ignoring its own heritage and its own tradition. At the same time, and perhaps it wasn't very different in the time of Amos, there is a faithful remnant of Jews in Israel and elsewhere, Jews who do honor their own tradition, criticize their own government, and seek for their Palestinian neighbors the justice which in many times and places they have, as Jews, been denied. I remember being particularly grateful to Dr. Ursula Franklin. Anybody ever hear her speak or know who she is? Professor emerita at the University of Toronto, originally a Jewish refugee from Europe in the 30s, I believe. She has the title of Distinguished Professor at the University of Toronto, which is an honorific title given to the greatest teachers there. And I did have the privilege of meeting her at SFU a few years ago. And I honor her for what she said during the Israeli siege of Gaza at the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009. A dreadful attack on a defenseless people, an attack which killed 1,300 Palestinians, including 400 children. Those beautiful children I saw up here this morning. 400 children. Well, weren't any Israelis killed? Yes, 11. And she said that when she, as a Jew, says, never again, she means never again for anybody, not just Jews. Well, this is a hard issue to get a handle on sometimes. Something that prompts many of us to keep our distance from this issue is what appears to be its complexity. And in fact, I've noticed among people who really don't want to discuss it, they will say, oh, it's just so complex. And yes, it is complex. In terms of history, claims and counterclaims, and religious and political perspectives, but paradoxically, while being complex, it is at the same time simple. I'm just thinking, gosh, that applies to human beings. We are so complex, every one of us. And at another level, we're just so simple. I've said that. I've told you what we're against. So what are we for? What do we need to do in the midst of this complexity and simplicity to end the conflict? Can it be simply stated? Yes, it can be simply stated. We simply need to end the occupation. To end the conflict, end the occupation. Let Israelis take responsibility for themselves and Palestinians for themselves. I'm just suddenly remembering, I'm getting all kinds of flashes here in this sermon. I went to a conference, how old was I, 30? And I went to a conference in California, and one of the leaders said, to be an adult is to take responsibility for yourself. I was 30 years old, and that had never occurred to me. That I've gone to university, I've, accomplished various things, but to take responsibility for myself. What a thought. Well, is this going to happen anytime soon? Probably not. The current peace talks, you can see my dislike for that term, so-called, facilitated by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, are in my view doomed to failure. And when they do fail, you can expect the Israelis to blame the Palestinians, and you can expect the Palestinians to blame the Israelis. Well, after that gloomy little comment, you may well ask, where can we find hope? Let me tell you a little of my own story. I retired from full-time teaching at SFU in 2004, and in 2006, I went on a big rock in the UK, 600 kilometers, one pair of boots, no blisters. I wanted to draw a line between my teaching career and my troisième âge, which some people call retirement, but I was avoiding that term. And before I went away, I resigned from all my responsibilities. So when I came back, I sat down at my beautiful, clear, clean desk and asked the universe, shall we say, this question. Given that I'm not going to live forever, what is the one thing I should focus on for the rest of my life? I'm suddenly remembering my mother telling me when I was 20, I think, that I was spreading myself too thin. Okay, Mom, but it's all important. Yes, it's all important, but you can spread yourself too thin. So here I am coming back, moving into retirement. I don't want to spread myself too thin. I want to focus. What's it going to be? Well, I'll quote Gandhi again. When Gandhi, I taught a course on Gandhi at SFU. When Gandhi was trying to make a decision as to what he should do in terms of his struggle for the independence of India, he used to just sit down and wait for it to rise up from within. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I sat there at my beautiful, clear, clean desk and looked out the window, and it only took about 90 seconds, and it rose up more quickly than I can even tell you about it. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Okay, that's a challenge. That'll keep me busy for the rest of my life. When people say to me, what are you doing these days? With a straight face, I say, I'll bring you peace to the Middle East. Oh, really? And then I say, well, somebody has to. So I interviewed a number of Jews and Palestinians, and I concluded the best way to go about it was to put together a public education program which would help the general public understand both the complexities and the simplicities of the situation. And that program is called Building Bridges Vancouver. And if you Google our name, you'll find our website and an account of what we do. And I certainly enjoyed hearing that Building Bridges song this morning. It's being active, being active in this program, that I have found hope. Because I've met so many other people who have made a similar commitment. It's particularly encouraging to work with the members, for example, of a group called Independent Jewish Voices. Jews of conscience who stand against what is still the majority view of Canadian Jews, a view based on fear and woundedness, that Israel must be supported at all times and at all costs, just or unjust, right or wrong, supported. All of a sudden, I am reminded of Stephen Harper, because this is his view as well. Okay, a second sign of hope. Since the Second World War and the shock of learning about the Holocaust, Israel has had the implicit sympathy of the Western nations. Do you know what I mean by that? You know, the Holocaust, how terrible. Israel, a little country surrounded by enemies, making the desert bloom. They have this story to tell, and we heard it, and we accepted it. And something I've noticed, not just in this context, but in others, whoever gets their story in first gets believed. And then when there's another story, an alternative narrative, you begin to wonder about, well, is that true or not? But there's a bias, there tends to be an implicit bias in favor. You know, isn't this what happens with little kids? One little kid comes in and says, Johnny beat me up. And then Johnny comes in and says, Billy took my baseball bat or whatever. Well, the first person to get to mom, tends to get her ear. Mom has quite a diplomatic challenge in a situation like this. So that was certainly my own feeling during most of the time at SFU when I was teaching a course on the Holocaust, which I did for 9 years. It wasn't until the last time I taught that course that a student made me aware that there was also a Palestinian narrative. You know that old proverb, when the teacher is ready, the student will appear. Oh no, it's the other way around. It's the same thing. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear, and in this case, the teacher was my student. However, as the years have gone by, Israel has squandered, that's a very specific term that I'm using, squandered that sympathy by its brutal treatment of the Palestinians, much as the United States squandered the outpouring of sympathy it received after 9/11. Remember after 9/11, how our hearts went out to the Americans, and what did they do with it? That baseless attack on Iraq. At the same time, the Palestinians have learned new ways to tell their own story. They're catching on, and that I find very hopeful. Since I started working on this in 2008, I've just seen an exponential rise, a steep learning curve on the part of the Canadian general public. Not big enough yet, but big. A third sign of hope is what is called the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. This is what made such a powerful contribution to the end of apartheid in South Africa. And the Israeli government is super unhappy with Desmond Tutu for pointing this out. And according to a recent article in The Economist, anybody read The Economist? Okay, I don't either. One hand, one brave hand, okay. It's not a knee-jerk left-wing journal by any means, The Economist. And according to an article in The Economist, BDS is making a powerful impact on the Israeli government. Of course, that government dismisses it as just a new form of anti-Semitism, not recognizing that if anti-Semitism is on the increase, and in some places it is, it's the policies of the Israeli government that are generating it. Now, your song, Standing on the Side of Love. My friend Mariana Harris, who's a retired United Church minister, believes that at the same time we support BDS, we have to do something else as well. We also need to express love for Israel by asking it to live from its best self rather than its fearful and angry self. And isn't this what we try to do with those that we love? We challenge them to live, as Abraham Lincoln said, from the better angels of their nature. And isn't this what we really, at a deep level, want those close to us to do with us, to appeal to the better angels of our nature? Somehow, Mariana says, that as we're immersed in the miseries of this complex and simple conflict, we need to keep our hearts open to a vision of transformation, of how the positive values at the core of Israel's tradition and accomplishment can be highlighted as we speak out against the distortions of justice that now seem so dominant. She says that rather than only seeing Israel as the occupier, which it is, one can also hold a view of Israel as a future leader in transformation. Just as Israelis pride themselves on having made the desert bloom, they could lead the world into a place of monumental turning from power over to power with, power together. Now I'm going to get all mystical and spiritual on you. But hey, this is a church, after all, and share with you some thoughts that came to me last week when I went to a lecture on Rumi, the 13th century Persian Sufi poet. Remember that first song, Come Whoever You Are? That's a Rumi poem. So stay with me, it's all connected. The spiritual journey, according to Rumi, requires that we move from what he calls the phenomenal or surface self to the universal or deep self through prayer, meditation, and the practice of virtue, in his case, according to the Sufi tradition. Then, as this happens, as people living in and out of the universal self, we become persons of love. And as persons of love, only then, in the full sense, can we be persons of justice, which is loving persons is what we seek for all others. Have you got it there? Mm-hmm. First love, then justice, which is why, as last week's speaker that I went to hear said, love matters for justice. Well, what this means, friends, is that in a universe where everything is connected to everything else, we can contribute towards the resolution of this conflict by becoming persons of love who seek justice. As the German-American philosopher-theologian Paul Tillich used to say, justice is love distributed. I did a book review on a book that he wrote on that subject 52 years ago. I can't say I really understood it then, but I get it now. Justice is love distributed. This means putting the energy of love where it is needed. This is not love as feeling, and I'm not denigrating love as feeling. It's about love as action. It means loving the Israelis and Palestinians, whether we like them or not. It even means loving Stephen Harper, whether we like him or not, which means calling him, as the universe calls us, both as individuals and societies, to live not out of our superficial selves of fear and anger or an egotism, but out of our inmost and deep selves to live in the strength of the better angels of our nature. Well, I'm going to give the last word to Amos. We've heard it before, but let's hear it again. For Palestine, for Israel, for Canada. I'm going to read it, and then I'll offer it to you one sentence at a time, and I'll ask you to repeat after me. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Let justice flow down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Amen.
Amen.